Our featured speaker of the evening is Dr. Jim Lark. Dr. Lark is the regional representative to the Libertarian National Committee for us. He's the former national chair of the party from 2000 to 2002. He is the vice chair of the Virginia State Party. He is also on the board of the Advocates for Self-Government, Students for Liberty, and the ISIL, International Society of Individual Liberty. He is a professor of statistics and of information and systems engineering at the University of Virginia. In 2008, he won the Thomas Jefferson Award at the National Libertarian Party Convention for Lifetime Achievement. In 2004, he won the Sam Payne Award for Outstanding Activist. And last year in Vegas at the National Convention, he won the Thomas Paine Award for Outstanding Communicator. I got the chance to meet him in 2001, my very first state convention in Bill's Point. He spoke on where we are and where we're going. And I was very impressed, and it's been now 12 years and 3 presidential elections since then. I thought we needed an update, and he's been kind enough to come up and speak. Please welcome Dr. Jim Lark.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Since I don't have a microphone, I'm going to use my stentorian voice here. I'd like to thank Bob Johnston for his very gracious invitation. It's great to be here with so many friends of liberty. I'd also like, I haven't had the chance to do this often, I'd like to thank Scott Spencer. As you may know, Mr. Spencer is the Region 5S alternate representative of the Libertarian National Committee. It's been a pleasure to work with him. He goes to a great deal of time, trouble, and expense to attend the meetings, and since I'm always there to run my big mouth, he doesn't really have an opportunity to say very much, but he's always there. He's been a tremendous colleague, and I'd like to publicly thank him for his time. Also, if you don't mind, I'd like to dedicate this speech to my father, who passed away about a month ago, and his birthday would be next Sunday, so I hope you don't mind my dedicating it to him. He was a man of libertarian disposition who supported me in all of my libertarian activities, so I'd like to, if I may, dedicate it to him. The title of my address, as Bob said, is The Libertarian Party, Where We Are, Where We're Going. And I gave the speech, as he said, several years ago, so I guess this will be an opportunity to update it. I'm still going to use some of the same material because some of the things I said 12 years ago are still true. And I hope you'll find it interesting. By the way, in a moment, I will reach back and grab my, thank you, I will grab my glass of tea. It hit me as I was sitting there that exactly 7 years ago, I was able to address the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia. And I don't know if you know where Grundy, Virginia is. It's in the far southwestern part of Virginia. They actually have a law school there. As the old joke goes, it's not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. And it was a Friday night event. They invited me to come down and talk about the libertarian movement, the Libertarian Party, and they managed to attract actually a very large crowd by virtue of having buffalo wings and beer. And so I was able to stand in the well of their law lecture hall drinking a beer, addressing all these wonderful law school students, and I congratulated them on their progressive view toward education in law school. Unfortunately, this is just iced tea, a little bit lower octane than what I was drinking that evening. Hopefully the quality of my talk will be as good as it was when I had the higher octane beverage. The Libertarian Party is, I'm going to point out what I hope is obvious, the Libertarian Party is simply one part of the great wide, worldwide libertarian movement. And whenever I give a talk like this, I want to make sure that people understand the context. The LP is simply one part of a much bigger movement. I'm one of those people, even though I had the opportunity to serve as the chairman of the Libertarian Party, I'm on the National Committee, I've been on the National Committee for a while, some people would say much too long. I am not a party hack. I think the Libertarian Party still provides a very important vehicle for reaching out to people. But again, the Libertarian Party to me is simply a vehicle. It's a tool that we use to help build the liberty movement. And thus, when I'm working toward liberty, I look at the party as simply a tool. It's, I think, a useful tool, but it's simply a tool. It's one part of a bigger movement. So what I'd like to do is point out, and the start of my talk here, that the battle for liberty proceeds on many battlefields. And I believe that politics, which is one of the important battlefields, politics is a lagging indicator, as economists would say. I think we'll see political success after we've seen success in many of these other battlefields. So I'd like to describe where I think the current situation is with respect to some of those other battlefields, and then I'll come and address the Libertarian Party and our role in the Liberty Movement. I'm going to do something. I hope you don't consider this radical. I'm going to unbutton my coat. Danger is my middle name. The first battlefield that I want to address is what I think, in frankly, is the most important one, and that is the intellectual battlefield. I think if you look at what has happened over the last, well, really since 1947, when the Mont Pelerin Society was formed in Mont Pelerin, Switzerland, I think if you come forward from that point, the progress of the Liberty Movement has been nothing short of breathtaking, at least by historical standards. Go back to 1947. Europe was, at least large parts of Europe, were still in ruins at the end of the Second World War. You had the start of expansionist Soviet communism. You had also the foundations were being laid for the People's Revolution in China, which was to enslave, well, roughly a billion or so people. You had what were socialist governments in both the United States and Great Britain, socialist in everything except name. Remember, Churchill was turfed out at the end of World War II by Clement Attlee and the Labor government. In terms of the intellectual climate, I don't think it would be fair to say that socialism was the dominant intellectual trend. In fact, I don't think socialism has ever been, true socialism has ever been the dominant intellectual trend. But I think it's clear that among intellectual elites in the West, welfare state liberalism was the dominant strain. In other words, you could actually have nominal private ownership of the means of production, but it was heavily regulated. You were essentially renting, not owning. We had the start of massive provision of social welfare in terms of old age provision. Of course, Social Security had already come into being. We had a wide, wide variety of laws throughout the Western world in terms of regulation of what you could do in terms of employment. Minimum wage laws, for example, had been around since the 1890s. And so we had a very substantial intellectual commitment among elites toward, as I said, welfare state liberalism. In other words, a very large, very aggressive state sector. Well, if you come forward from 1947 to now, again, I think the progress we've made in the battlefield for ideas is truly amazing. If you look at the extent to which people who are serious advocates of welfare state liberalism, the extent to which they now feel they must fight against us, they must engage us on the battlefield, we now see lots and lots of major intellectuals who at one point would have been spending most of their time trying to explain to people why we need ever larger state activism in human affairs. Now they're having to defend their turf. They're now having to fight against us. And if you put this in athletic terms, and I'm a jock, I was a jock, if you look at it in, say, boxing terms, and I'm actually not a big boxing fan because I don't like to see people hit each other, but I think boxing actually provides a useful way of thinking about this. We're in what I would consider to be the third round of a 15-round prize fight. The champion, the belt holder, is welfare state liberalism. To the extent that there's a dominant intellectual strain in the United States, and for that matter in Western Europe, it would be what I would call welfare state liberalism. But the libertarian perspective is the principal challenger. We're in the third round, and the people in the welfare state liberalism corner are scared because they see the extent to which bright, talented young people, the creme de la creme of bright young intellectuals, are increasingly of libertarian disposition. And by the way, one thing I like to emphasize is libertarian is an adjective as well as a noun. There are people who I would not put in the category of libertarian the way I would Lorenzo Gastaniago or Dean Ahmad or Bob Johnston, libertarian exemplars. Well, in fact, everybody in here is a libertarian exemplar, but I mentioned those three libertarian exemplars because I just happen to be looking at them. Libertarian is an adjective. More and more we're seeing people, particularly bright, talented young people, who are libertarian in the way they look at things. They may not come to the same conclusions that we libertarian now come, but they're starting to think in libertarian ways. They're starting with the proposition that individual liberty coupled with personal responsibility is the proper natural way of things, And so when they consider, should we say expand the role of the state, they're now starting to think about it with the option, if you will, the preferential option being, no, we should not, unless there's a damn good reason for it. Let me give you a couple of very quick examples, both of them stemming from 1997. In the fall of August of 1977, my buddy Gary Westmoreland and I were walking around the University of Virginia in advance of the return of students to UVA, because what we would do is we would go put up all sorts of libertarian agitation and propaganda. We wanted to make sure that when students and their parents came to visit the University of Virginia at the beginning of the fall semester, that you couldn't fling a dead cat without seeing libertarian stuff. Well, we were walking through, believe it or not, the engineering school, and there was a poster on the wall. It was a poster put up by the Advocacy Institute, which was a liberal left group run by Michael Perchuk, or at least he was the chairman. Some of you may remember Michael Perchuk. He was Jimmy Carter's FTC chairman, pretty bad guy, very statist oriented. Well, this poster advertised for 3 internships. You could come to Washington, D.C., work for the Advocacy Institute on one of 3 projects, the second one of which was to fight libertarian rhetoric in the media. Now, when I read that, I had a big smile on my ugly mug, because it showed a recognition on the part of people who are on the other side of the ideological fence that we're making real progress. The second example, also from 1997, September of 1997, I was sitting in my faculty office at the University of Virginia about 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. The phone rang. A buddy of mine said, "Jim, are you going to go hear Fareed Zakaria tonight?" Fareed Zakaria at the time was the managing editor of Foreign Affairs. Of course, he's been gone on. He's now a major media figure. But at the time, he was managing editor of Foreign Affairs, a fairly prominent position in the world of ideas. And I said, "No, Joe, I don't think I will. I'm too busy." And he said, "Jim, do you know what the title of Dr. Zakaria's talk is?" No. "Are Libertarians Nuts?" So at 8 o'clock, when Dr. Zakaria began his talk, I was essentially close enough to the podium that I could reach out and slap him if he said anything impertinent. I didn't sit there because I wanted to slap him if he said something impertinent, but I was close enough to be able to do so if I wanted. Dr. Zakaria, who was introduced, he speaks English absolutely beautifully, as only non-native English speakers do. Speaks beautifully. He began his talk by saying, "Some of you probably saw the title of my address, 'Are Libertarians Nuts?' And it was pointed out to me how powerful and strong the libertarians are here at UVA." And again, I started to get a big smile on my ugly mug. He said, I'd like to change the title to really what I want to talk about. And that title is, 'What's Wrong with Democracy?'" And he proceeded to give a talk that I think would warm the hearts of most people of libertarian disposition about the problem of conflating what we really want, which is limited government, private property, rule of law, in other words, the classical liberal libertarian vision, the problem of conflating what we want with pursuit of democracy. He pointed out that there are various hell holes around the world that have democracy. He pointed out some of the problems of democracy. For example, you know, it's not all that hard for us to think, you know, gee whiz, 50% plus one get to impose all sorts of nasty things on minority. And I was sort of looking around the room, and I noticed that all the socialists who had come to hear him slam the libertarians, they all had pouty faces by the time he finished his talk. And his essential point, which he summed up very nicely, was it was actually the libertarians who have the right vision. And the reason people think of the libertarians as nuts is because we're very consistent, and we want to go all the way. And in a sense, we're doing this perhaps before people are really ready to see where we're going and why we want to get there. But he pointed out that it was we, the libertarians, who were the people who had the right vision. Now, you might say, "Dr. Locke, that's an interesting story. Why did you bring this up?" Well, let's think about it. Dr. Zakaria is asked to give an address at the University of Virginia, fairly prominent university, as UVA people will tell you, in a very pretentious fashion, we're a very prominent university. Why would he title his address, "Are Libertarians Nuts?", if he didn't think anyone would care about the topic? And by the way, the room was full, I might add. It was the Jefferson Society that was sponsoring his address. And I've seen many, 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 many signs of how people
who do not share the libertarian vision of individual liberty coupled with personal responsibility, who they're now having to fight to protect their turf, as they see it. More and more, we're seeing the bright, talented young people, some of whom are here today, I might add, I'm delighted to see it, who are now able to articulate beautifully a libertarian vision. They understand the ideas in a way I certainly didn't when I was their age. At their age, they were still wiping the drool off my chin. And at the rate I'm going, they'll be wiping the drool off my chin again in the not-too-distant future. They are able to explain the ideas beautifully. And one thing that is of great satisfaction to me is they're nice young people. They're the sort of young people you'd like to have as friends, neighbors, son-in-law, sister, daughter-in-law, perhaps, an affectional friend. They're the sort of young people who are going to change, and indeed are changing, the world. The bright young people increasingly see things our way, or at the very least are not reflexively hostile to the libertarian perspective. And I think that this is due, by the way, to the work of a lot of wonderful people, some of whom are in this room today. You deserve great credit for reaching out, explaining these ideas with courtesy and with respect. There's a second battlefield where I think that the progress has been somewhat uneven. And it's somewhat difficult to define this battlefield clearly. And by the way, the battlefields I'm talking about, there are no clear, bright dividing lines as to whether this battlefield stops and this battlefield comes. In fact, they all tend to sort of run together at various places. The second battlefield I'll refer to as a cultural battlefield. I think that there are cultural institutions, matters of culture, that make libertarian societies more or less likely to be successful, to be more or less likely to be desirable. And I can sum this up by the "there ought to be a law" sentiment. Now, you might say, well, isn't that part of the intellectual battlefield? Well, yes, in some sense, yes. But really, no. An awful lot of what we see today involves institutions such as manners, the way we treat other people, the extent to which people look at, this is a problem, let's deal with it as part of civil society as opposed to political society. Now, again, part of this, it does sort of slop over into the intellectual battlefield, but there's an awful lot that I think is purely cultural. I chose my parents wisely. I wanted the best, that's what I got. My mommy and daddy taught me that there are certain things, there's certain respect that you have for other people. Okay? When I'm driving around, and when I'm driving my suburban assault vehicle, for example, if I'm listening to music, and if I just happen to have the windows down, which I usually don't because you get better gas mileage usually with the windows up, but if I happen to be driving along and I've got the windows down and I come up to a traffic light where someone else might hear my music, I instinctively turn the music down because I don't want my music to impose on someone else. When I'm in public, there are certain things I do as a matter of course because I don't want to impinge upon other people. This is not, by the way, a result of my thinking through very carefully to say, what are the property rights in this matter? Am I actually violating some property? It's just something I was taught to do. You respect other people. You respect their stuff. And so I think over the last 100 years, but certainly the last 50 years, the "there ought to be a law" aspect as part of culture has accelerated. I attribute this largely, though not by any means completely, to the fact that as we become a more urbanized society, as the distance between people, the physical distance decreases, I think it becomes a lot easier. As we also have more and more mobility in society where you don't necessarily know your neighbors all that well, it's a lot easier to try to, in a sense, say there ought to be a law. Because, by the way, your neighbor is playing his stereo too loudly. Maybe in the past you would have just gone and said, well, first of all, your neighbor might have been 5 miles away, so he'd have to have a really big stereo to play it too loudly so that he would be disturbing you. But also now, you're perhaps a little less likely to go over and tap on your neighbor's door and say, excuse me, could you turn it down, because you don't know if your neighbor's Jeffrey Dahmer or some other not particularly pleasant fellow. He might say... So... And again, I think that when I was growing up, at least, of course, I grew up in a very nice community, very nice. It's not much of a place to visit, but it's a very nice place to live, Pulaski, Virginia. I think people were just raised with a sensitivity that you respect other people. You treat them the right way. And the right way means you don't dump stuff on their property. You don't, you know, if you happen to smoke, you don't smoke in their face. There was a certain sense that you tried to respect other people's rights. And again, you could say, well, is this part of the intellectual battlefield? I don't think so, or at least not by any means all of it. And I think that one of the areas that we as libertarians have to do is we have to try to point out, or we have to work toward, essentially improving what I would consider cultural conditions to help make a libertarian society more appealing. Because right now I think a lot of people, for reasons that they can't necessarily articulate as an intellectual matter, but they have sort of a gut feeling that a libertarian society would allow a great deal of license. And I think that we have to give consideration to, are there cultural matters, cultural institutions, where we can help move the ball down the field in a liberty-oriented direction? There are a couple of other battlefields that I could talk about, but because of the time issue, I'll cut to the political chase. On the political battlefield, I think we're actually, the Libertarian Party, I think has actually done not too badly. We could have done better. We could have done a lot worse. The Libertarian Party is playing in a rigged game. Our opponents get to write the rules for us. They get to enforce the rules against us. But even more importantly, we libertarians are playing in a game that does not favor us. Why? First of all, most libertarians don't like politics. We have what statisticians would call a huge selection bias problem. Libertarians don't like politics. Every one of you in this room is unusual. And I mean unusual among libertarians in the sense that you were willing to take your valuable time, perhaps invest a non-trivial amount of money, to be part of a political activity. You have been involved in purposeful political activity. That makes you unusual among libertarians. Most libertarians are people of libertarian disposition. They want to live their lives in peace, in harmony with their neighbors. They don't like politics. Politics for them is dead weight loss. It's sure, in my case, it's a lot of dead weight loss. In some cases, there are libertarians who believe that being involved in politics is the hair of the dog that bit us. They feel it's immoral to be involved in politics. Arguably, the biggest short-term task of the Libertarian Party is to get libertarians to join the Libertarian Party, because most people of libertarian disposition are just not interested in politics. By the way, a comment was made, actually a point that Mr. Blitz made earlier. One of the things I've observed, I've been involved in campus organizing for the better part of 30 years. And I like to flatter myself to say I know a little something about this. Up until very, very recently, the vast majority of libertarian college students were not involved, they did not want to be involved in partisan political activity, at least not in the sense of being involved or officially associated with a partisan political organization. They were in some cases interested in politics, but it tended to be more issue politics. And if they got involved in a partisan political organization, frequently it was one of the legacy parties, we might say, one of the older, larger parties. At the University of Virginia, I founded Students for Individual Liberty when I was a graduate student many centuries ago. Students for Individual Liberty, which is an educational, nonpartisan organization, has always been much larger than University Libertarians, which is our political, partisan political organization. It is only recently that I've started to see bright, talented young libertarians active on their college campus be interested in partisan political activity. And it should be noted that a lot of those who are interested in partisan political activity are keen to be involved, say, with the campaign of Dr. Paul, Ron Paul, who runs as a Republican. So they're not necessarily coming over and getting involved in the Libertarian Party. But I have seen an increase in the extent to which at least bright, talented young libertarian activists on college campuses are interested in being involved in a partisan political effort, and that partisan political effort is the libertarian partisan political effort. Another big problem we face, and I sometimes make a nuisance of myself at Libertarian Party affairs, with all due respect, I don't think the American people are nearly as libertarian as we would like to think they are. Let me give you an example. Leave me alone. That's not a libertarian sentiment. It may reflect libertarian sentiment, but it is in and of itself, it's not a libertarian sentiment. Leave me alone means leave me alone. Doesn't mean leave Johnston alone. We can't afford to leave Johnston alone. I mean, he's dangerous. Cut my taxes means cut my taxes. Doesn't mean cut your taxes or Bill Gates' taxes. I think that there is a leave me alone tradition in the United States, which I think has helped us tremendously to keep us from going much further in the statist direction. I think it has been a big... We also happen to have certain institutions, namely a federal constitution, which recognizes certain rights that we have. For example, right to keep and bear arms. I think that's a big one. These have helped us. But again, we have to understand, at least from my perspective, the American people, while they may have libertarian impulses on certain issues, and in some issues, some matters, those impulses are pretty strong, I frankly do not think the American people are as libertarian as some of my Libertarian Party colleagues suggest. And if my analysis is correct, that means that we have to do a lot more spade work in terms of helping people to understand how a liberty-oriented society will work. I've already mentioned the fact that we're playing in a rigged game. We play in a game where Democrats and Republicans get to set the rules for us. Also, if you were to have invited Bill Redpath, my distinguished colleague, to address you, he probably would have been pointing out that a third party in our system, the very nature of single-member plurality districts, first-past-the-post voting, he would suggest that we're never going to be successful. If by successful you mean electing large numbers of libertarians so we become a first party as opposed to a third party. Now, I'm not sure whether that's correct or not. In some sense, it may not matter, because I think the Libertarian Party can ultimately succeed regardless of whether we elect anyone. I mean, you can lose a lot of battles and still win the war. And in fact, if you put a gun to my head and force me to choose, is the right way of going, if we boil down the Libertarian Party's strategic vision to one of two, emphasizing direction or emphasizing destination. In other words, destination, the shining city on the hill, what a liberty society will look like. By the way, I'm about as radical as they get. I call myself a rational constitutional anarchist. I don't grant the state any a priori validity to exist. To me, governments are like clubs. Now, there's a double entendre there. I don't mean like great big sticks. I mean, you define the polity by voluntary agreement. You can actually, we can call the voluntary agreement a constitution. But I believe that you can basically form societies either by peaceful, voluntary means or by something else. Okay? I'm about as radical as they get in terms of how I look at these things. However, a lot of our fellow citizens, sort of my perspective is one that they don't necessarily share. Perhaps because of the provincialism of time, to use T.S. Eliot's phrase, many of our citizens are now at a point where they've never seen how a liberty-oriented society might work. There's an apocryphal story. It may even be true. I'll mention it. I think it was 1991, the Cato Institute sponsored a symposium in St. Petersburg after massive communism had fallen in the Soviet Union. There was a conference of liberals in the right sense of the term. And Gavril Popov, who was one of the liberal mayors, a liberal in the real sense of the term, liberty, evidently got up and said, here in Russia, we need to move to civil society to improve life of Russian people. However, of course, there are certain things only government can do, such as military, roads, and of course, bakeries. Now, whenever I mention this, and again, it's an apocryphal story, I didn't hear Mr. Popov say this, we all laugh at this. But think about it. If you grew up in a society where provision of bread was always the province of the state, the idea that you might be able to decide how much wheat to grow and to bring the wheat together and actually make bread and then you can distribute the bread, the idea that private market forces could do this might seem utterly fantastic to you. And I think that for many of our fellow citizens, the idea that we can band together freely and voluntarily without using the coercive mechanism of the state and produce benefits for society, healthcare, for example, through friendly societies, insurance through mutual associations. The idea that the many of the big problems of the human condition can be addressed at least as well through private, voluntary, eleemosynary activities. For many of our fellow citizens, this is just fantastic. So I think an important part of where we need to go as we move forward is essentially to reacquaint Americans with American history. And there are many scholars, David Beto is one of my favorites, who have written and written extensively about the forgotten history, say, of voluntary societies that helped to provide, say, medical care for people. The so-called you may have heard of the so-called lodge practice evil. When the Flexner Commission reported, of course, we had to deal with all these evil lodges that were actually going out and negotiating with doctors on behalf of the lodges so that the prices of doctors, the labor rates of doctors were not going up. They might actually come down because people could use their marketing power, their bargaining power. I think that we need to help people rediscover the American history of voluntary social aid. And I think it is a very rich history, one that convinces me that we don't need government to be involved with so many things with which it's now involved. So, where are we going? You've heard me before. I tend to be very optimistic. Well, I'm just a naturally optimistic kind of guy. I'm sort of a cockeyed optimist. But there's a reason, in this case, to justify or support my cockeyed optimism. One is, to say it very bluntly, we're right. Societies based on principles of individual liberty coupled with personal responsibilities are better societies. I think by any reasonable metric you wish to choose, they're better societies. They're wealthier societies. And I don't mean by wealth. I don't mean simply the focus upon TV sets or toaster ovens or more cars. I mean wealth in the sense that people are free to pursue their visions, their dreams, their God. The only restriction is they can't violate the like rights of their neighbors. Ladies and gentlemen, that's a truly beautiful vision, one that extends love to our fellow citizens. Because we may say, you know, that Johnston guy, I may not like anything about him. I mean, he may be, he's a fellow, I don't want to have anything to do with the guy, I don't want to trade with him, I don't want to look at him, but I'm not going to violate his rights, because his choices, as long as they do not violate the rights of others, it's his life. And I'm not going to use the big stick of the state to hit him. Again, I may choose not to associate with him in some fashion, but I'm not going to use the force of government to run his life. That's a truly beautiful vision. It is one that I think people will flock to. And like the old Monty Python line goes, I'm not only proud about it, I'm smug about it. Also, I think to a much greater extent, now people are starting to realize the cost of the overly large, overly intrusive, overly expensive state. That cost is now being made manifest in so many ways. And there are a lot of people who are going to, they're going to realize they got stuck with the check pretty soon here, and they're not going to like it. Also, I think to a greater extent, many people, I'm tempted to say many thoughtful people, of course, I want to be a little careful because that sounds a little snotty. I don't know if you ever remember the film The Comancheros, where Edgar Buchanan says, most folks, except them that's unfair, think of me as the brightest legal mind in the Southwest. So most thoughtful people more and more are starting to see that one of the biggest problems with the overly large, overly intrusive, overly expensive state is that it breaks down the bonds of real community. It breaks down the bonds of community. It makes it, in many cases, it actually takes what ought to be win-win situations where people can come together for their mutual benefit, and it makes it zero-sum, winner versus loser. I also agree. By the way, Charles Murray, unfortunately, when Charles Murray and Richard Herrnstein wrote The Bell Curve, unfortunately, Charles, his reputation for various reasons suffered. Charles wrote, in my opinion, one of the best books for explaining the beauty of a liberty vision to people who perhaps are from a more contemporary liberal vision. It was called In Pursuit of Happiness and Good Government. If you haven't read that book, I suggest you do. I think he lays out beautifully the case that at least you might be able to help people who don't share the liberty vision. I think you might be able to improve your ability to share that vision, and perhaps you might improve the ability of other people to understand that vision by pointing them in the direction of Dr. Murray's book. I feel that one of the really horrible things is the extent to which the big state, in many cases, as I said, breaks down the bonds. It makes it harder for people, in many cases, to come together through voluntary action. How many situations have we seen where government actually outlaws, or at the very least makes it damn hard, for people to help their neighbors? In many cases, just simply going out and handing a meal to some poor slob who's on a steam grate. The government makes it difficult, if not impossible. And we won't even get into issues such as minimum wage laws, which basically price people out of the market. We won't get into the war on drugs, which have basically pulverized our inner cities, where you have so many young African Americans who will probably never be able to get a job because they've got felony convictions, or at least it'll be very hard for them to get jobs. The overly large, overly intrusive, overly expensive state has basically, I won't say it's destroyed large parts of our society, but it certainly has made life very hard for people who in many cases simply want to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And more, I think our many of our fellow citizens are starting to see that point. They're starting to see that government is a very blunt instrument that simply cannot solve the major problems of the human condition. Government can do certain things reasonably well. It can kill people in great big bleeding batches, which it does all too frequently. And in some cases, perhaps there's a need for that at times. But by and large, the biggest problems of the human condition, at least the biggest problems within the United States, are ones government just can't solve. It doesn't have the knowledge, and it doesn't have the moral competence. So more and more, I think, as we come up with better ways, as we learn how better to reach out to our friends and neighbors, to explain a truly beautiful vision that is supported, I think the case is overwhelming, on purely prudential grounds, purely on practical economic grounds, that less government is better, that smaller government is better. Now again, I'd like to get out the magic wand and wave it and eventually reduce it to zero. But whether we can go that far, I'm willing to discuss that. At the very least, I think we can reduce the size scope of government drastically and improve the lives of our fellow citizens. And so with that, I could go on for several hours, and I'm sure that you would love to do that except for all the things you have to do tonight. So what I'll do is I'll open it up for a brief question period. I'll go as long as you guys want to hear me talk, which might be a very long time. So let's you cut it off when Bob when you think they're ready to. Yes, sir.
Dr. Clark, one of the things today's government is worried about is too big to fail. You hear that a lot. You know, banks too big to fail. Other financial institutions too big to fail. A lot of business. So we really implemented a libertarian solution or pathway. You know, if they are failing,
First of all, did everyone hear the gentleman's question? Perfectly good question. The short answer is I'm not sure what the best way to address that person's concern is. I don't know the best way. I have some ways that I would try. The first thing I would suggest is, and I'm not sure that people will necessarily buy this, but I would suggest that the vast majority of those of the comments that say, well, this bank is too big to fail, that those arguments are just wrong. I mean, essentially what happens in problems of the sort we dealt with is simply banking failures typically are not like earthquakes or hurricanes that actually destroy wealth. Essentially what happens is with banking failures, typically what happens is you have redistribution of assets. Basically, people who did own them now no longer own them. Now, the value of assets may drop and drop significantly, but that can happen under any circumstances. I think that if we had allowed the banks that were too big to fail, what would have happened is, yes, some people were going to get including some people who perhaps were small depositors and the like, were probably going to be hurt. I don't think there's any way around that. But I think ultimately, over time, it would have been much better for the system. You also would not have essentially institutionalized a very bad rule. Now, is there ever a point where there is a bank that's too big to fail in the sense that if it collapses, it does basically bring down the house of cards on everybody, including the prudent as well as the imprudent? That's a possibility. I think that's an empirical question. I can't answer it with certainty. My feeling is that all of the rhetoric that we heard about what happened in 2008 and also in various panics in the past, I think the rhetoric was horribly overblown. Again, there's no doubt that if you have a bank failing, that one, it can cause a ripple effect, no doubt about that. Two, some people who may not have been complicit in the problems, they might get hurt. That's a possibility. I mean, that can happen, by the way, with government action, since we all got hurt. Of course, the argument was, if government is involved in these bailouts, we'll hurt people a little bit as opposed to having some people being hurt a lot. Again, I'm not sure that there's any argument that I can offer that will conclusively prove that we ought to move in a market-oriented direction, a liberty-oriented direction. There's a certain sense in which if people believe that a bank was too large to fail, I'm not sure I can prove to them that that's not true. I'm not sure I can prove it to me that that's not true. All I can do is to try to explain to them, first of all, I can explain to them on some economic grounds that that probably was not likely to be true, but again, I can't prove it. The second point is, even if it is true that some people would have been badly hurt by this, you're now instituting a rule which basically, essentially, it actually will make it more likely that you're going to have too big to fail problems. And we're going to eventually end up with essentially government propping up an awful lot that it doesn't need to prop up. Now, again, I don't know if that answers your question. This gentleman was raising his hand. Yeah, go ahead, sir, if you'd like to make a comment.
James Greer Miller, Living Systems, especially in the...
Could you speak up, sir, so that everyone can hear you?
James Greer Miller... He wrote a book called Living Systems about the 1950s and 60s. He had a living motor network. He said it's everything from the cell to the transnational corporation. It's more of they were too big to succeed.
Yeah.
Basically, an operation was carried on. The ability to transfer accurate information goes down. So you end up with more management costs if you get bigger than you get profit, if you will. And that's...
By the way, I want to make it very clear. I'm not dismissing... I want to emphasize, I'm not dismissing the possibility that there might be a bank or perhaps a small set of banks for which the nature of the contracts, given the nature of fractional reserve banking, given the nature of how people were essentially pledging various assets essentially to multiple contracts, multiple contingencies, it is possible that one bank could have failed and it may have caused substantial problems for other banks, perhaps even to very healthy banks. That's a possibility. I can't prove that that would not have happened. I don't know that anybody could prove it would or wouldn't have. I think what those of us who believe in essentially reducing the size and scope of government point out, first of all, is that in many cases these claims were coming from people who had very strong self-interests, okay, that by propping up the people, the principal beneficiaries in many cases would be the very people who would lose the most, who were basically the residual claimants, the owners, okay. In some cases, bondholders as well. I mean, there were cases of bondholders, but in many cases, those were sophisticated investors. So I think that a question like that, if someone asked me that, I would first say, this is a complicated question. I'm not going to be able to prove one way or the other. So I would say, you know, take what I'm saying with the appropriate size grain of salt. By the way, I hate it when I hear people, economists, who talk with abject certainty about this would have happened or this wouldn't have happened. In many cases, they just don't know. Maybe they've got good evidence or they've got reasonable support for their position, but we, frankly, we just don't know. And I would prefer to be a little bit more humble in terms of what I would say would happen or would not happen. I think we just don't know. My feeling, though, is if we had allowed the banks that were too big to fail, there would have clearly been dislocations. But the principal victims, if you will, were people who would have, or owners, residual claimants, who basically would have had their wealth wiped out, as opposed to socializing the cost of their imprudence, in which case we all lost something. I saw, oh, heavens, Betsy, let's this gentleman will go around. Yes, sir. Could you speak up, please?
There's one thing that I'm very convinced of from what I see, is that a great many people, particularly adults, have lost confidence in themselves and don't trust that people will do the right thing unless they're forced to do it. And this is a very major problem, because even when you suggest good things, people will say, well, in an ideal world, that would work. And you're an idealist. That's, I've heard that told me during many times. But they don't think of a practical matter of workers. They don't really trust.
Actually,
that self-confidence, and how we get that back, I don't know.
Sir, I think the gentleman has put his finger beautifully on a point to emphasize. Again, when I talked about this issue of a cultural battlefield, I think a substantial part of that losing trust in your fellow citizen is part of that cultural battlefield. I think that there, in terms of looking at the other guy as, I can't trust him. Some other dude did it. I can't trust this guy. I think you're absolutely right that a substantial degree of trust we have in our fellow citizens has, for various reasons, or in some cases for very good reasons, because
you can't have a voluntary society and other people.
Absolutely. And indeed, one of the things if you ask me, when do I think a libertarian society is going to come about? I don't think it will come about until a large part of that trust, or at least that willingness to take a chance, has come back. So I think you put your finger on an extremely important point. If you have a situation where you can't really trust your neighbors to do the right thing, I think that that makes it much more likely we'll see that there ought to be a law, that we have to have a government mechanism that uses force to prevent people from doing bad things. And in this case, preventing people from doing bad things does not mean shooting you, raping you. It means being improvident, being imprudent, being a horse's rear. So I think that your point is extremely good. Sir?
Regarding the question that Mike asked about the bank, during the crisis itself, I use an expression I have not heard anyone use before. The Luggage This Morning is published the first time in the Washington Post. I don't know how I got from News and Post. So whenever anyone asked me at that time, what about banks too big to fail? I said, any bank too big to fail is too big to exist. And the point was that there's only one reason these banks are that big. Is the government intervention. You cannot take as a given the problem that it's causing it and then prescribe more for you. There was a movie about the banking crisis. I can't remember the title at the moment. It was a mockumentary docudrama. And when someone said it to one of the bankers in a meeting was discussing how they're going to solve the problem, and they're going to have Bank of America take over some of the banks that are failing. And one of the participants said, well, let me get this straight. The problem was that the banks are too big, and the solution is that we're going to make them bigger. If the government is offering inducements to Bank of America, it's not going to do it otherwise. And that sums it up.
Now, Dr. Ahmad, as is usually the case, puts his finger on an extremely important point. And by the way, this actually points out one of the problems of addressing the question that Mike just put. Let me step back a little bit. About 30 years ago, I had the honor of being a visiting scholar, visiting schmuck, at the Center for Research in Government Policy and Business at the University of Rochester. At least they were the ones who laundered the money for me. George Benston was a professor of accounting and economics at Rochester. He was one of Milton Friedman's students. good guy, man of libertarian disposition. He went to hear a talk by Michael Harrington. Some of you may remember or at least know the name Michael Harrington. He was one of the founders of Democratic Socialists of America. He wrote the book The Other America. I think it was published in 1963. Evidently, Mr. Harrington gave a lecture at the University of Rochester. George attended the lecture. I didn't. And George pointed out something very interesting. He said, Harrington is making, on average, two serious errors per minute. Errors either of fact or interpretation. To clean up any one of these errors would take me at least 15 minutes. In other words, they can dump manure faster than we can shovel it out. Shovel out the stable. I have found this to be the case that, for example, someone, and again, you don't have to posit any sort of intellectual dishonesty or lack of integrity. Many people, you know, Samuel Johnson's wonderful line, most ideas are not propagated by reason but are caught by contagion. People read an article in Newsweek magazine. Well, the banks are too big to fail. Well, I guess the banks must be too big to fail. Trying to explain why that might be, at the very least, highly questionable is going to take a bit of time. And being able to address a question where someone has a very strong logical prior, it sometimes is difficult. That's why what I try to do, when if I have the time, I'll try to let them do the talking, let them explain why they think the banks were too big to fail, and then perhaps if I can offer a useful point, I'll do so. But we need to understand, and this is one of the problems we face in our advocacy. In many cases, what people all know, you know, the thing, well, everybody knows this, ain't true. And an awful lot, by the way, on college campuses, an awful lot of the work I do in terms of advocacy for liberty on college campuses has nothing to do with promoting the basic moral perspective of the libertarian vision, which to me is the big issue. It's the moral perspective. It's not necessarily the prudential issue. It's the moral perspective. There are basically limitations on what individuals can do to others, and either that's individually or by virtue of government. The big issues in many cases are not the basic morality of the libertarian perspective, but what happened to the poor in the Industrial Revolution in England? Or what happened to all of us in the Great Depression in the United States? In other words, we find that we're ending up debating very badly caricatured history. And this is a game that's hard to play. Because if you're trying to promote an idea of liberty, and the people with whom you're dealing, their history is, I'll say it gently, their history is questionable. It's going to be very hard in many cases to help them see these ideas, because if they're saying, well, look at, this is what happened in our history. Well, no, that's not what happened in our history, but I don't expect them to believe that straight away. In fact, they shouldn't believe what I'm saying. In fact, what I hope they will do is, I'll suggest, would you please go look at these resources? Maybe you'll get a different viewpoint. Maybe these resources are wrong. Maybe the people I'm reading, maybe the history I've read is wrong. But at the very least, perhaps you should consider a different perspective. And I think that by virtue of doing that, I can at least open them up a little bit. Again, I think your point, your basic point is that there are, we can respond to people, perhaps opening them up by saying, as you say, the bank is too big to exist by virtue of the fact that it was propped up, it was promoted, it had all manner of subsidization, perhaps legal protection, perhaps they could default on their contracts and not be held accountable. There are so many ways in which we can open them up. But we need to understand, in many cases, they're not going to be able to swallow that whole hog. That's why I try to be very careful when I deal with the questions of the sort that Mr. Linder asked, because people in many cases, if I give them sort of the whole hog approach, I think they'll just reject it out of hand. Okay, I saw questions here and here. Yes, go ahead.
Well, this has nothing to do with banks or anything of this whole thing here. It has to do with something you said earlier about how the libertarians who run for office are
And that's not just the ones who run for office. I mean, everyone here has been willing to invest a non-trivial fraction of their time. Please. No, strange is better. Strange.
Okay. I had a thought came across my mind, and I said, in every group of humans, there's always some humans that take it upon themselves to defend the territory.
Yep.
And I think that's really what it is. We are the group of humans in this group of humans that take it upon ourselves to defend the territory. That's it.
Mm-hmm. I think your point is well taken. When people who know me well, you know, sort of reflect back where I came from. If you went to talk to my high school chums, and you said Jim Lark was going to grow up to be the chair of the third largest political party in the United States, he'd be heavily involved in politics, at least in terms of being a party hack. I don't think I'm a party hack, but they might look at me as a party hack because I'm involved in sort of the administration of the party. I don't know that they would have laughed at you, but they certainly would have been surprised because I was not interested in politics. Now, by not interested in politics, I read the newspaper. I kept up on current affairs. When I was first able to vote in election, I did. I voted basically every time since. But I don't like politics. I'd much rather be up here talking to you about the virtues of good beer, or the fact that the NCAA men's semifinal basketball games are being played. Or we could talk about beer, or perhaps good food, or maybe we might digress to beer. So, I hate politics. I'm involved in politics because I can't ask other people to defend my rights if I'm not willing to do so. I'm hopelessly bourgeois. I'm a creature of duty. I cannot ask you wonderful people to invest your life, your liberty, your property in working for my liberty if I'm not willing to be up there on the firing line with you. I just can't do it. Other libertarians don't seem to be... And by the way, in fairness, there are many different ways of promoting the liberty perspective. When people ask me, Jim, and I don't know why they would ask me, as if I'm a guru here, what should I do? The short answer is, I don't know. The longer, more nuanced answer is, I don't know, but I've got some ideas. You can be tremendously helpful in building the liberty movement by simply being a really good person in your community. Because for so many people, we of libertarian disposition, we have this silly notion that everybody knows what a libertarian is. You know, libertarian is still sort of an alien word for a lot of people. If you are a self-identified libertarian and you are a person of integrity, of virtue, of goodness, you're nice to your neighbors, you treat people with respect, and you are identified as, oh yeah, the Gastañagas, they're nice people and they're libertarians. When people start identifying exemplars of liberty as those nice people, you're making progress. If you're a business person and you go out and create wealth for other people because you're an honest person, you basically create value for others, you sell at a price people are willing to pay for, in other words, you're not getting the state to step in and say, surely you want to buy my product. You got a nice place here. It'd be a shame if something was to happen to it. You know, things break, don't they? If you're creating wealth for people, in many ways, you're making it easier for people to live their lives in peace and harmony. You may be moving the ball down the field. There are so many ways in which, just by being a good person and a self-identified libertarian, you may make it a lot easier for people to think, oh, those libertarians, I may not agree with them, but they're the nice people. They're good people. They treat people with courtesy and respect. I can trust them. If they somehow get in a position of responsibility, they're not going to steal my wallet. They're not going to send my kid into some goddamn meat grinder to get killed. They're actually going to treat people the right way. I may disagree with them. I may have disagreements with how society will work in an atmosphere of liberty coupled with personal responsibility, but they're basically good people, decent people, and the world's not going to go to hell if they're put in positions of responsibility. Look how far you have moved the ball down the field. Let me digress very briefly. Very quickly.
Can I
Very quick. Yeah, beer. All right. A point of communication. Some of you may know I have the honor of serving as the chairman of the board of directors of the Advocates for Self-Government. So the idea of how we explain and promote our ideas in the most effective fashion possible is something that's near and dear to my heart. I've discovered something over the last 30 or so years, and I want to encourage you to understand this as you go out and try to explain our ideas. You may already know this, and so I apologize for boring you. Our vision, as I said, is a truly beautiful, compelling vision. Individual liberty coupled with personal responsibility. It's a beautiful vision. And precisely because it's such a beautiful vision, precisely because I think societies ordered on those ideas are better societies, wealthier societies, there's a natural tendency among libertarians, at least those that I've observed, when we go out and explain it, we're really disappointed when people don't buy in whole hog to our perspective. I have seen the light. I have seen the great white light. I have braced in the bracing waters of Murray Rothbard's wisdom, and I have become a libertarian. I have seen the light. That's nice when you can help somebody embrace the great white light. But by and large, that doesn't happen, or at least you don't see it happen. What happens is you facilitate conditions by which people convince themselves. You open people up to thinking. I never convinced anybody of anything. I help facilitate conditions by which people will convince themselves. And I've learned that many libertarians, they're so disappointed when people encounter these beautiful ideas, they don't immediately embrace them. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if all you do by virtue of treating people with courtesy and respect, representing your ideas with care, with concern, with humility, if all you do is clear away the misconceptions that people have about the libertarian perspective, how many people have you encountered who have this badly caricatured view of what libertarians are all about? If all you do is help clarify what libertarians really believe, if all you do is clear away the misconceptions, you have moved the ball way down the field, because in so many cases in politics, people become involved not because they like the guy they're supporting, but because they fear to death the people that they oppose. And if you help convince people that libertarians, we want the same good things for our friends and neighbors that other people do, if you show them that what we have, we want good things for the people, we care about others, we have a better way of going about it, one that respects individual liberty, one that encourages diversity of preference, one that embraces the ability of people to live their lives the way they see fit, as long as they don't violate the like rights of their neighbors. You will have moved the ball down the field, and many of the big victories you win are not because you have to find the great next exemplar of libertarian ideas, but because you help clarify misconceptions so that people don't feel they have to fight against you. Also, by virtue of treating people with courtesy and respect, clarifying when people have bad impressions about us, bad caricatures, you may help keep people from going completely the opposite direction. And those are victories you're very unlikely to see, but they are victories nonetheless. And ideological revolutions of our sort proceed inch by painful inch. I happen to be very optimistic about the future because, again, ladies and gentlemen, we're right. Our ideas are simply better ideas. More and more, I think our friends and neighbors are starting to see what the problems of big government are when we present our ideas with courtesy, with respect, with humility. I dare say we'll help our friends and neighbors understand that liberty is the preferential option. And with that, I guess I'm being given the hook. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your work for liberty.
Thank you everybody for coming out. I want to thank Kim for all her help. Thank you.